And now it's time to start the day. And our first presenter this morning is Kevin Trueblood. Kevin is a 16-year veteran of the radio industry and currently is a broadcast engineer for Wisconsin Public Radio. Starting his career while in high school, Kevin has worked in stations in Illinois, Iowa, and Wisconsin, doing everything from news, sports, on-air, and programming before switching to engineering full-time in 2007. Kevin has a degree from Northern Illinois University. We won't hold that against you. And he currently lives in Madison. Please welcome Kevin Trueblood.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here this morning, and it's great to see everybody here today. You know, over the last year since I've started playing with a lot of these new devices that have come out, these Wi-Fi links, I've talked to a lot of engineers who have been very enthusiastic and very optimistic about the technology, and some are understandably skeptical about the technology because they think it's the Wild West out there. You're in territory that's unregulated. And, you know, for a lot of them, I think, well, it's not as bad as you may think. And I almost thought about changing the name of the presentation to this. With some proper planning and utilizing some of the tools, you can actually get a pretty usable link out of some of these technologies, and the prices have come down to make it very affordable for us to do so. So why extend your station's LAN out to a transmitter site? Well, in 2013, a modern transmitter facility, everything's got an Ethernet port. Your audio processor, your switchers, your EASs now need Ethernet and internet connection. And now Mr. Welton's selling transmitters that want to get on the internet. And we've often installed DSL or used a fraction of our T1 or something else that's a hard line out to our transmitter site. But the disadvantage to those kinds of things is that we incur a monthly cost. So if we can extend our station's LAN out to the transmitter site with a permanent fixed radio, then we get to save those monthly expenses. And then the GM passes those savings on to you, because that's how that works, right? With the development of new remote controls, and especially yesterday we learned about a lot about the SNMP, technologies, being able to get to your transmitter via Ethernet or just your site in general gives you a lot better control and a lot of better monitoring of your equipment. You get to see a lot of statuses and you get to see a lot of good graphical interfaces that kind of make it like a My First transmitter or something like that, like a Fisher-Price device. But it's nice because then you can monitor multiple sites at once. And you don't have to wait for dial-up, and you don't have, although you might miss the sexy Burke voice that calls you in the middle of the night. With the addition of an audio codec, it can become your main or your backup STL. And yesterday we were learning a lot about the advantages of like the composite AES, or being able to minimize the number of things that are being squashed and packed. Well, now you can utilize uncompressed audio, or you can extend your station's LAN out to your transmitter site and be able to plug in like an Axie or a Wheatstone node and basically make it native to your studio system. If you have a voice over IP based phone system, you can just plug in another phone at the transmitter site and you have an extension out there. You don't have to have a monthly landline out at the transmitter site. Although one tip I was just reading over the weekend on a mailing list, a good suggestion to this is if you do this, make sure that that extension or that phone number has the correct address associated with it, because if you dial 911, they may show up at the wrong address. And of course, internet access for site PCs. I can't tell you how handy it is these days now that everybody's got tablets or having a PC at the site. Being able to have manuals on a computer is so handy, because rather than spend time endlessly flipping through the manual trying to find something, you can just search for it. So it's handy to have the internet access out at the site for PCs. And good for offsite backups, whether it's for your automation system, your billing system, or for your file server. It helps to have something offsite, good for disaster recovery should anything happen to your studio. So why should you go unlicensed? Well, for one thing, there's a lower cost associated with it. If any of you are familiar with some of the new generation of equipment from, say, Ubiquiti, and there's some other providers as well, the cost has come down significantly. You can install systems that cost a fraction of what it used to even 5-6 years ago. There's no need for coordination. You don't have to file anything. You don't have to check in with the frequency coordinator for the area. You just put it up and turn it on. So that saves you the expense of having to go through all those hoops. And similarly, no need for re-coordination. If you want to move it, your transmitter moves, your studio moves, you don't have to, again, file anything. You just do it. And available bands may have some advantages over licensed bands, and I say that specifically for things like weather. The unlicensed bands are typically better for weather. They don't or aren't as susceptible to things like rain fade and snow fade. And again, advances in technology have made them far more reliable and far more robust. When you're able to spend less than $1,000 and get 100 meg throughput to the transmitter site, that's pretty good. 10 years ago, Mosley came out with the LANlink devices, and that was groundbreaking because suddenly you have 512K on a good day out to your transmitter site. And those devices work, and they're wonderful. But again, they're slow, and you're not able to do as much with them as you are with some of the advances in the technology. So why not unlicensed? Well, the obvious one, you have no protection from interference. Somebody gets on your signal, you have no real recourse against it. So that's the obvious one. So let's talk about the most widely used bands, the 902 to 928 megahertz band. There's also the 2.40 to 2.48 gigahertz band, 5.15 to 5.875 gigahertz, and the 24 to 24.250 gigahertz bands are the most commonly used unlicensed bands today. So we'll go through some of the bands. If you're using the 902 band, the maximum transmitter power output is 1 watt, and the maximum EIRP is 4 watts on these devices, so you can't go above that. There are some rules to the band, anyway. So let's talk about some of the advantages of using this band. Well, the great thing about this frequency is that you likely already have the hardware on hand to do this. If you have a 950 STL, well, you've already got an antenna that's going to work with that. You can combine it with your existing 950 STL, and typically you have minimal loss. Even if your antenna is up 200-300 feet, yeah, you're still not losing that much, especially if you're using like half inch or 7/8 inch line. You're probably not going to have much issues. And because of that, because you're using the antenna up on the tower and you're not having the radio up on the tower, you're not limited to Ethernet. So you can have your antenna up 500 feet. You don't have to worry about not having Ethernet up there. And that's a great band, too, because that can get through a lot of stuff. It's good for propagation. It's one of the better bands in terms of the unlicensed. Disadvantages, you don't have a lot of channels to choose from. If you are operating there and you're starting to get interference, you don't have a lot of wiggle room. There's only about 6 channels available to use in that space. And this one's not a huge deal, but just something to be aware of, that harmonics do fall into the licensed spectrum. So even though we're using very low power equipment, if there's something on site, it may interfere with it. It's just something to be aware of. When we talk about 2.40 to 2.485 gigahertz, the maximum transmitter power output, again, 1 watt. The maximum EIRP is 4 watts. You can start to increase the antenna gain, but once you get above the 36 dBm, for every dB of gain that you increase the antenna gain, you have to start derating your transmitter power output, similar to how you do with the FM signals. We talk about the advantages of the band. This one's better for path obstructions when compared to, say, 5 gigahertz, so it can typically work around those things. On average, you can get 40 to 50 miles. That's over a good plan link if you want to get the full 20 megahertz bandwidth out of them. I've heard the world record for this band is 140 miles somewhere over in Asia. I've heard that there's nothing like that can happen in the States. Disadvantages to the band, this is where a lot of the consumer products lie. When we talk about Wi-Fi access points, Bluetooth, cordless phones, a lot of those sit in this band. So this is where you're going to see a lot of the consumer interference. So as such, you're more prone to interference. Again, you can increase the antenna gain, but you do have to keep in mind that you have to start reducing your transmitter power output. And on this one, again, when you compare it to, say, the 5 gigahertz band that we're going to get to, fewer channels to operate simultaneously on. So if you've got a few people that are in your area that are really on those on that frequency, again, you may not have as many options to move around to maximize your signal. I call this 50 shades of 5 gigahertz. There are a few different bands that you can operate in within 5 gigahertz. There's the low, the mid, the worldwide, or some call it the mid-upper, and then the upper band. The upper band is what we typically refer to when we set up 5.8 gigahertz links, or they call it 5.8 gigahertz links. That's the most commonly used one. But you can use other ones. The lower band, you are limited to the 160 milliwatt EIRP, and this is where a lot of indoor Wi-Fi access points operate too. This band's not intended for outdoor point-to-point links. This is where if you have a 5 gigahertz indoor access point, this is where it operates. And in the middle band, you can go up to 800 milliwatts. If you're using the worldwide or the middle upper band, you do have to protect against radar interference. It also depends on your area. Some on the West Coast say that there are no radar stations in that area, so you don't have to worry about it. Most of the radios that you can buy that operate in that band have the intelligence built in to be able to shut down or move channels if they detect interference. So let's move up to the 5.8 gigahertz, the upper band. Again, the maximum transmitter power output is 1 watt. There is a maximum EIRP, but you have a lot of wiggle room. You can go up to 12 watts in that band. Advantages of this band, as of right now, there's less interference. You have a lot more opportunity because not as many devices are working in this band as of right now. And because you do have more wiggle room, you can increase the antenna gain without having to decrease the output power. So if you want to put up a 12-foot dish, you can put up a 12-foot dish and really focus that signal, which should help overcome a lot of interference. And this band is great because there's a lot of available channels to operate on, whether you're operating on them simultaneously to be able to maximize your throughput or to be able to move around and avoid interference. This band is great for that because there are a lot of different options. On average, 30 miles is about what you can get, again, if you want to do the 20 to 40 megahertz bandwidth. But it is possible to go higher. You just start sacrificing your bandwidth and your throughput to start going further distances. A lot of the vendors that I've talked to, especially with Ubiquiti, they say 30 miles is about where the cutoff is. Disadvantages to the band, this one is less tolerant of path obstructions. So if you've got trees, if you've got a ridge in the way, if you've got something that's in your path, it may not tolerate it as well. And again, it's not good for long shots if you want to get your full throughput. If you want to start seeing the 10, 20, 50 meg throughputs, you're probably not going to see it for the long shots. And real quick, we'll talk about the 24 gigahertz band. This is where you're going to find a lot less interference because these are not really intended for long shots because they can't go that far. But if you're using devices like air fiber, or the large gigahertz type links, this is, as far as throughput, I should say, gigabit links, this is where you're going to put them. The disadvantages, this one's obviously subject to rain fade, to weather fade, and works over very short distances. This is a perfect band to use if you've got, say, an office 2 blocks away, and you don't want to run fiber, or you can't run fiber. It's perfect to set up between the two links. And not incur any monthly charges either. But if you're trying to shoot 5 miles to your transmitter site, it's probably not going to work. So let's talk about making the most out of your links. The wonderful thing about us is we already have the vertical real estate to rise above the interference. When we talk about devices operating within the band, they are typically in people's houses, their access points, their cordless phone systems, and they're operating, you know, in three-story apartment buildings. But if you've got a 150, 200-foot STL tower, and similarly you can go up 200 feet on your transmitter tower, well, you're going to put yourself above most of the interference to begin with. So that's going to help minimize the interference. A lot of these devices have built-in spectrum analyzers or site surveyors to tell you what's out there. And that's going to help you select the best channel to operate on. If you see large spikes or large saturations in the band, you can move around them. So that'll help you work around what may be out there. And of course, that can change at any time, but the beautiful thing is if you do start to notice interference, you can fire up the site surveyor or the spectrum analyzer and move and help hop around that. If you do have some interference, it's going to add some latency to your signal. So it means your packets are going to have to work around that interference. Difference in radios, chips, the hardware can add latency. If you are using different manufacturers, if you're even using different chipsets like Broadcom or Atheros, those can add latency because there's a translation that has to go on between the two manufacturers, and that can add some latency because it has to think about getting them through the hardware. Keeping devices to a minimum, using point-to-point mode. And what I mean about that is if you're using it as just a general wide open access point, anything can connect to it, it's constantly going to be looking for other devices to connect to it. If you lock it down to certain MAC addresses, if you lock it down to just talking to one or two devices, that's less it has to think about. So it's just going to be focusing on connecting to one or two devices and talking between those two devices. And that's going to help keep your latency low. And similarly, if it's got any kind of intelligence to it, if your access point has firewalls, if it can be a DHCP server, again, turn those off. Just make it a transparent network bridge. Just let your switches in your studio, in your transmitter building, let it manage the traffic that's going through it. Just let it be a completely passive device. It's just throwing the zeros and ones back and forth and the packets. The reason why I keep talking about keeping latency low is because it adds the ability to, it gives you far more flexibility to run codecs in PCM mode. If you're running a codec in PCM mode, it doesn't have a lot of room for buffer. And so if it starts detecting some latency, if there's something intermittent or it's not consistent, you're gonna get a lot of because it just can't work in that way. Now if you're going with some compression, if you're doing MPEG, that can certainly help with that because obviously you can add some buffer and it can correct those packets. But if you're trying to go uncompressed or you're trying to do something like the composite AES, keeping your latency low allows you to use the uncompressed linear codecs. Also adds the ability to multicast too. If you can keep it really low, then you can start multicasting or send multicast data over those as well. If you do have high latency, they don't tend to play well with the ability to multicast. I'm talking to radios. And as Jeff Welton would preach, it is a device that is up on your tower. It's a lightning rod, so treat it as such. Use shielded cable, ground the shield, use ferrite chokes. Anything that you would do to normally shield, ground those devices, you'll want to continue doing that with these devices as well. And to get the most out of it, to get the most throughput, the maximum bandwidth, Cat6 is the preferred cable. A great tip that I had read about using these, again, if you've already got the real estate for, say, a 900 megahertz link, and you're setting up a 2.4 or a 5.8 gigahertz link on your tower, the price point has come down so low that you can actually add more than one. So you can have a 900 megahertz link and a 500 gigahertz or a 5 gigahertz link, and you can set them up to be redundant. You can use a managed switch on either side to fail over, or just one of the gateways to fail over to one of the bands should one of them not work or you have start to have problems. If you're using devices like the Ubiquiti radios, they have the ability to start compressing the bandwidth. So by default, they tend to come out of the box at 20 or 40 megahertz, which is great because it'll give you a lot of throughput. But you're also utilizing a lot of channels, and if you're trying to go a long distance, you may not be able to get as much throughput to the site. The signal strength may not be as good. So focusing that, reducing it to 10 megahertz or 5 megahertz, 3 megahertz, even though you're sacrificing that throughput, you're still able to get 10, 20, 30 megs out of the signal. And that's certainly enough to be able to send audio back and forth, a linear audio, and still have overhead to send general traffic and telemetry and whatnot. So that'll help overcome interference especially if you go down to 10 megahertz or 5 megahertz, you are then operating on one channel or a part of a channel. So then that's going to help you work around some interference. If you see somebody that's taking up multiple channels, then that'll help you just kind of avoid that interference. Things to be aware of. Don't just presume that because your transmitter's out in the middle of nowhere, the bands are wide open. A lot of rural ISPs use the wireless ISPs, and they have been sitting on those bands for a long time. So don't just presume that you're out in the middle of nowhere, they're empty. They may be in full use, there may be a lot of interference. So use the spectrum analyzers, the site surveyors, to see what's available. Again, just don't presume that it's wide open. A lot of the radios are smart enough to hop frequencies and adjust bandwidth automatically to adjust for interference, but in my experience, that may create more problems than it solves in terms of dealing with latency. If it's trying to figure out where to move and it's constantly changing channels, it's going to mean a lot of lost packets as it tries to negotiate around that. So what I've typically done is I've typically set it for one frequency and leave it there. And if I do start to incur some problems, then I will look at, again, what the site survey is telling me and then move channels as necessary. But your mileage may vary on that. Coming 802.11ac devices may create more interference, especially in the 5.8 gigahertz band, due to simultaneous use of multiple channels. These devices are coming out that are using 80, 100 megahertz of bandwidth, so they're sitting on 5, 6 channels at once. And that's great for you if you're the one using it, but if somebody else is using it, that may cause more interference for you. So that's just something to be aware of. If you see somebody smoking the band, well, that would probably be why. Again, if you're using the integrated radios and antennas, your height is limited to Ethernet limitations. So you can't just put something that has the radio built into it 400 feet on your tower because it's not going to work. So keep in mind that you're either going to have to regenerate your Ethernet somewhere along the line. I've heard people running fiber up the tower and then tapping into the tower light circuits and putting a node up on the tower, and you can go up there. So just keep that in mind that you are limited to the 300 and some feet for Ethernet. Obviously, with security, because you're putting your stuff out there in an unlicensed band, you do want to worry about security. It works, at least with the Ubiquiti devices, it works very similar to Wi-Fi. So how you lock down the Wi-Fi in your studios, how you lock down your Wi-Fi at home, it's very similar to how it works with some of these devices. So you want to treat it as such. Hide the SSID. It's not foolproof. If somebody wants into your system, they'll find a way. It's part of the risk that you do take in utilizing these services. But hiding the SSID at least makes it less obvious to what you're doing. And restrict access to specific MAC addresses. The only other device that it should talk to or that should be allowed on that access point is the other radio it's talking to or the other radios that it's talking to. If you are using like the Ubiquiti lines or any other one, utilize their proprietary encryption. A lot of them have a specific language that they talk into each other. Ubiquiti calls it the AirMax. And if you turn that on, normal Wi-Fi devices can't really connect to it. It'll error out and it won't work. So it does utilize a proprietary encryption, so they can't really see what's on your data or what's going on. So let's take a look at how this is actually being used. About a year ago, we set up one of these links at WHA here in Madison. Why did we need a new STL? Well, our existing STL was an equalized phone line and had limited bandwidth. Not to mention, in 2013, the phone company is going, dry pair? What's that? So we were facing limited support, and of course, Steve Johnston, who takes care of the site, he had just done an upgrade to the HD equipment out there that did actually go, like yesterday we were talking about widening the bandwidth on the analog audio and the HD audio to make it sound better. So we needed something that gave us a little bit more bandwidth than the 5 kilohertz you get from the phone line. The site has a number of backups, including licensed options. If you hear WHA with silence, something's seriously wrong. Seriously wrong. And we were just about 2 miles away with perfect line of sight. From the roof to the tower, perfect line of sight. So we went with the Ubiquiti AirGrid 5.0 gigahertz system with a 27 dBi antenna. Overkill for what we're doing, but it was $10 more than the lower one. And I figured I'll overbuild it because I can. The best part was the total cost for the hardware was about $350. That included the 1,000-foot spool of Cat 5, of weatherproof Cat 5. For the two radios and the Cat 5, pretty inexpensive. If you add in the cost of the audio codecs, it brought it up to about $1,500. So how did it work out? Well, we're using 40 megahertz of bandwidth going out there. We're getting 100 meg of throughput. So we're running uncompressed PCM streams out to the transmitter site, averaging 2 to 3 milliseconds of latency. One of the vendors I talked to, he's like, I've never seen it that good. Maybe he was just, you know, patronizing me. That's fine. But 2 to 3 milliseconds of latency is pretty good for that kind of a link. And running Barrix audio codecs in PCM mode for STL, again, using that linear mode, that gives you the best quality, and it lets you go straight out there without any kind of compression. And try as I might, I tried with that, even with the linear STL running, the linear codec running, and with other streams going out to the site and file transfers, try as I might, I could not get it to break. I was pretty happy about that. And because I've got so much throughput, we have an old uplink satellite dish out there that we now use for a downlink and a spare satellite receiver out there. So again, utilizing a codec running in PCM, I'm bringing back audio from the transmitter site just for redundant satellite use in case the satellite dish at Vilas falls off for some reason. It gives us a nice backup. There's a lot of flexibility you can get in utilizing and being able to extend your LAN out to your transmitter site. When we first put it up, the latency was inconsistent. When I was doing ping tests out there, I was getting 10 milliseconds, 5 milliseconds, 700 milliseconds. I'm going, what in the world is going on? Why can't I make this work very well? And of course, the Barrix was then going, When I looked at the spectrum analyzer, I noted that there was some intermittent interference. It was literally spikes that kept coming up in the channel that we were using. And I've set it to auto mode. It was the default. I set it to see how it would perform. And it was sitting right on the channel that was getting interfered with. So I went, we'll move a few channels down. Let me see how this works. This one doesn't look like it's as crowded. I did that, and in nearly a year, we have not had any problems. Knock on wood. Small footprint, too. This is the actual antenna and the actual radio. It's about 18, 20 inches wide, very lightweight. So if you're concerned about adding any wind loading to your tower, should be a non-issue. It's very lightweight, very small. So for most towers, it should not be a problem. And just showing again the ping tests that I was getting out there, again, averaging 2-3 milliseconds. So real quick, I just wanted to show you what the bands are looking like out there, utilizing the spectrum analyzer that's on the radios. I just kind of did screenshots of certain locations to see how the band actually looks. Just out of curiosity to see, is it as bad as we think it is? We're looking at the 5.75 to 5.85 gigahertz band from Vilas in downtown Madison on a college campus in a city center or near the city center. What you're looking at here, and I don't have a laser pointer, but what you're looking at down here is the green is the typical noise floor. And the yellow, if you can see it down here on the bottom, is the current noise floor. And then there's a blue line in there that it's not showing up as well, but that's the peak noise floor, well under 100 dB. So we're doing pretty good. And similarly, not showing a whole lot of saturation in the band. So it's pretty wide open. Looking at the 900 megahertz band, again in downtown Madison, college campus, near the city center, at the 900 megahertz band, again, the noise floor, still below 100 dB. It's doing pretty good. And on the other end of that link, out in the middle of nowhere, by Paola, Wisconsin, again, noise floor still down around 100 dB, so enough to be able to work with. And if you've ever been up to Duluth, Minnesota, and seen the transmitter hill that's up there that has pretty much every broadcaster, maritime communications, everything that's up there, there's a lot going on. And the noise floor is indeed higher. You can see it's up around 80 for average. Peak is up around minus 75, and unfortunately, there's not a whole lot that can work up there. When you have a noise floor that high, you'd probably be able to get something to work, but it may not be as reliable or as good as you may like. And that's pretty much the conclusion of it all, or for what I have. My overall point being, the price points have come down to a point, like I mentioned, for $350 you can set up a link. It's come down to a point where you can convince your GM to say, can we try this? Because even if it doesn't work, you're not out that much money. And I'm sure you can find some application for it, whether you're beaming back and forth at a remote broadcast, you can find some application for it. And the links are getting more inexpensive, they're getting more reliable, and so it's something that you may be willing to explore, especially given how much flexibility it gives you. So we can take questions, if anybody's got any.
Yeah, I'd like to add that I've had good experience adding or retrofitting these devices in as substitutes for the Mosley LandLink. Just dropping it right into the same chassis and using the combiner that does exist already there. And so you can upgrade the bandwidth availability for a 900 megahertz link.
Yeah, a lot of vendors have mentioned that they have just taken the LAN links and have just plugged in the 900 megahertz Ubiquiti stuff. And you can even, in fact, use the LAN link as your combiner. Because if you've ever looked at a LAN link, the whole chassis is just an empty box. The actual radio and the combiner is on the back of the LAN link. And so you can just substitute what the LAN link has and plug in a 900 megahertz radio of your choice and utilize that. That'll give you a significant upgrade. Yeah.
The example you gave of WHA, is that from the Beltline TOC to the Arboretum or from Vilas to the Arboretum?
That's going from Vilas Hall, so
from
on
Vilas
campus to the WHA site.
And are there any, do you use it on the hot tower? Is it on the WHA hot tower or?
It is on an adjacent STL tower.
Okay.
That's on site. But that's a good point. If you do have it on a hot AM tower, you are going to have to then obviously set up an isocoupler to get around the Ethernet, or to obviously get around the hot tower. But a fun analogy, and I think I've heard somebody doing this, is if a price point is so low, you can set up two links. If you can get power to those radios from the tower, from like a tower light, well, you don't even maybe have to worry about isocoupling. You can just set up a radio from one, run an Ethernet cable, and then shoot from the other end back to the transmitter building. No need to isolate it. Yeah.
Have you had any experience with double hops?
I have not. Well, I have actually, and I've heard some people having good experience with it. In fact, I just talked to Dennis Baldridge this morning, who is doing something like that. And the nice thing about him is if you're doing a double hop, it's a crossover cable. So if you've got your antenna receiving from one, in fact, the link that I set up, we were on a third, it was from the roof of a three-story building, and we were shooting to the roof of the 20-story building behind us, and the radios were looking at each other like this. And it's just a simple crossover cable from one radio to the other to beam back out. So you are eventually going to be at the mercy of the throughput of your weakest link, So if you get 100 meg on the first one and then 30 meg at the second one, well, that's what's going to be your eventual throughput. But there are lots of people that have set those up and had good success with them. Sure.
What's the longest path you've pushed this?
Me?
Yeah.
I have done probably a 5-6 mile path.
Did you have any trouble with rain fade or any kind of atmospherics blocking the signal?
Not with the unlicensed stuff. If you go up to the license bands, you're going to start running into weather fade. The link with WHA, probably the worst we've had. I mean, we've had some bad storms in a year, but I watched it not long after we set it up through a blizzard, and it didn't bat an eye. It was rock solid the whole time. But the further out you go, the more you do open yourself up to interference from rain and snow and things like that.
Kevin, excuse me, I'm a transmitter guy, so you, TV transmitter guy, so I don't quite understand all your technology. What kind of content do you put on that link? Are you talking about general IP communication that you're actually broadcasting, or is it just internet activity from your LANs that your guys use at the site? Is it telemetry, or is it all of that?
All of the above. It is basically an extension of your station LAN out to your transmitter site. So whatever you're doing at the studio, you're then just basically replacing a long Cat 5 cable going out to your transmitter site with this wireless link. And when I talk about the audio connectivity, you can use the audio codec of your choice, and in place of an STL, where normally you'd have like a commercial product that would translate the audio out to the remote site for you, the codec will replace that because it's just talking across a LAN like it would if it was in the building. So it's all of that.
When you were using the Ubiquiti links, did you find the encryption added any significant latency to them?
Not really. The link that we're using at WHA, it does have the Wi-Fi encryption, and it also is using the AirMax proprietary language that Ubiquiti has. And that's the results were exactly what I showed you. So it's just adding security to it. When I talk about adding latency, it's just if you're translating between, if it has to do any management of the actual traffic that's going through it rather than the signal itself.
Are you doing any audio video links on any license bands like 18 gig?
I am not. Our partners at the ECB are doing a lot of that over, I believe, 11 gigahertz.
Do you know what the throughput is?
I could. 150 meg.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
According to the guy who's running them. Okay. If there aren't any other questions, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to talk.